50 mark today. And today is going to be, I feel, a very interesting lesson.
Good.
So, get this open. All right, I will have that available in a second. Okay. So, everybody should have in front of them a set of notes for lesson 250, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, 1743, The Work of F.S. Paris. Okay? So, it's been an interesting week this week. Some new for a lot of reasons. But in the research front, there's been a lot of new ground covered that I'm excited to get to based on what we talked about last week. So, if you're joining us right now on the website, if you're live streaming or watching this after the fact, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down to December 22nd, click on the link for lesson 250, and then you will be able to load the notes that we're going to be following along here in class and be able to look at the images yourself as we track with this. Okay? So let's get right into it on page 1, introduction and review. In lesson 249, we began looking at the editorial work conducted by F.S. Paris for Cambridge University Press in the 1740s. Specifically, we considered his 1743 duodecimo edition. Professor David Norton views Paris's work as exerting editorial, quote, care for the text for the first time since the 1638 Cambridge folio edition. Look at the next sentence. Recall that Norton called the period between 1638 and 1743, quote, 100 years of solitude, implying that there was little textual care exerted during the period in question, except for occasional spelling changes and metatextual additions slash changes. So that would be, like the marginal notes, cross-references, stuff like that, okay? So that was his characterization. Likewise, it was observed by Professor Gordon Campbell. Likewise, it was observed, I don't like the way that reads, we'll have to maybe look at that. It was observed by Professor Gordon Campbell stating the following regarding F.S. Paris in his book, Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011. And he said, quote, in 1740, the syndics, so I got it right this time, okay, the syndics of Cambridge University Press declared their intention to, quote, serve the public with a more beautiful and correct edition than can easily be found. The task was entrusted to F.S. Paris, a fellow of Sidney Sussex, who would shortly become its master. He eventually became university librarian. In editing the text of the King James Version, Paris concentrated on the correction of textual errors, italics, and cross-references, but also attended to changes in grammar and in the meanings of words. The new edition, which was published in 1743, established important editorial principles. So we saw that last week as we were looking at the work of Campbell, okay? Moving on, trying to move quick through this introduction review. In lesson 249, we used Campbell's narrative to frame a discussion of 9 editorial changes that he attributed to the work of Paris in 1743. Norton does likewise in his book, A Textual History of the King James Bible, i.e., he ascribes all the changes noted in the previous lesson to F.S. Paris. Put another way, they originated with Paris's work according to Campbell and Wallace. So the examples we looked at last week, we had time, I think we looked at 8, if my memory's not mistaken. We had 9 in the notes, but we didn't have time to look at the last one. Of those, both Campbell and Norton say that those changes that we looked at are the work of F.S. Paris, either in 1743 or in 1762. Okay? Now, here's where I need you to remember something, because it's going to come up in this lesson. Recall from lesson 237 that Dr. Norton only collated the major Cambridge folio editions of 1629 and 1638, and therefore missed changes that were made by the lesser, smaller size Cambridge editions in the 1630s. So remember we saw this, right? I did a whole lesson in lesson 237 about the state of the text in the 1630s, and we looked at the smaller Cambridge editions, and I demonstrated to you how those were making changes that Norton didn't catch, because Norton was only looking at the large flagship folio editions. Okay? So that's important. It's going to come up again in this lesson. So since teaching lesson 249, since last Sunday, My friend and fellow researcher Christopher Yetzer brought to my attention that some of the changes noted in Lesson 249 had been made before the work of F.S. Paris was published in 1743. So as we observed previously with Dr. Norton regarding the Cambridge editions in the 1630s, both Norton and Campbell have overlooked the true historical origins of some of the readings attributed to Paris. Consequently, as helpful as their work is, it is not definitive and complete. Put another way, they missed things because they did not check every edition of the authorized version ever printed. Let's just stop right there. I mean, like, who has the time for that, right? Even if you could get your hands on every single one ever printed, who has the time to look up every single verse in every single edition and collate every single word, okay? I mean, can you imagine how long that would take, right? So let me read that again. Well, look at the next line at the very bottom of the page. While some might fault them on this account, I prefer to give them grace, knowing firsthand the immensity of the project. Checking every edition of the AV ever printed, assuming one had access to every printing, would be a truly daunting and time-consuming task. Okay, so any comments or thoughts on page one before we move on?
There's no technology
You know, maybe there is now. If you took all these PDF copies and there was some sort of AI or something that could collate them and aggregate it. Yeah, I mean, Campbell wrote his book in 2011. Norton's book, I think, was 2004 or 2005. The internet, even in those years, was not what it is now. Right? Just the availability of information. Okay? So I want to really quickly go through, revisit the list of verses that we looked at last week in Lesson 249. Okay? So by way of review, real quick, this is what we saw. Alright? We looked at Genesis 47:6. We saw the change from man to men. Alright? Matthew 26:75. The words of Jesus to the word of Jesus. So I have here, the words of Jesus was the reading, just so you know what you're looking at, in the 1602 bishops, the 1611, and the 1629, 1638 Cambridge folio editions. And we saw last week that this originated in 1704. This change, we thought, originated with Paris. Okay? We looked at Acts 7:35, the hands of the angel versus the hand of the angel. We looked at Exodus 34:25, the feast of Passover versus the feast of the Passover. That change was first cataloged last Sunday in a 1762 Paris Quarto edition. Ezra 7:18, the rest of the gold, the rest of the silver and gold versus the rest of the silver and the gold, right? Matthew 16:16, thou art Christ versus thou art the Christ. Luke 19:9, the son of Abraham versus a son of Abraham. Luke 20 verse 12, he sent the third versus he sent a third. And then John 15:20, greater than the Lord versus greater than his Lord. All right. So that was a quick rundown of the ground we covered last Sunday. So again, for each one of these examples, I gave you what the readings were previous. So we looked at the base text of the 1602 bishops, the 1611, and the two Cambridge folios of 1629, 1638, and then we noted, based upon Campbell, who we were following, his chapter last Sunday, these changes. Okay? Now, is everybody clear on that before we get page 3? Everybody good on the review and the introduction? Any questions? No?
Did editors ever make note of the changes they made, or did they just slip them in and forget it?
You mean like in some other document?
Just a reference that we changed this to that.
So, it's an interesting point. We're going to see this coming in the future. When Benjamin Blaney edits the text, he publishes an article in a contemporary magazine explaining some of the things that he did. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I would say that doesn't exist.
Except for the 1611.
Yeah, except for whatever we have surviving from them. Okay? So let's look at new findings on page 3. Okay? With the help of Brother Yetzer, I would like to present the following new findings. So this is new information that we did not know as of last Sunday. Okay? Look at Matthew 26:75. Oh, I skipped the line, I'm sorry. Of these 9 readings that we considered in lesson 249, and we just reviewed them in that list, okay, there is evidence that 8 of them were edited before 1743 Cambridge Duodecimal by F.S. Paris. Okay? So of the 9 we looked at, 8 of them were edited before Paris edited them in 1743. Okay? Now, what did Norton and Campbell claim? They claimed this work was original to who? Paris. But it turns out that it was not. All right? So let's look at some of these that we already looked at. Okay? Now, check this out. Consider the following photographic evidence from a 1683 Cambridge Quarto edition, and this is from Matthew 26:75. So this is a verse that we already looked at last time, but check this out. So here's the verse, Matthew 26:75, from a 1683 Cambridge Quarto, catalog number 780. Okay? And notice, and Peter remembered the word. Had that change already been made in 1683? Okay, and so Campbell was ascribing that change to who? To Paris. Okay, but had it been made quite a while before Paris did his work. So let's look at a little statement there. The change to word was made in a 1638 Cambridge Quarto printing bearing the name of Hayes as the printer and not by F.S. Paris as asserted by Campbell. Now, additional evidence from a 1677 Cambridge Quarto H736 records this change being made before 1683. So look at the next image. Here's one from a 1677 Cambridge Quarto H736, and you can see, and Peter remembered the what? So that's now 1677. So you got 1677, 1683. Has that change already been made in the Cambridge edition before Paris does anything in the 1740s? Okay, so look at it underneath that image. Consider the additional evidence from a parallel verse in Luke 22:61. This time the base text of the bishops read the word Jesus, and the 1611 followed suit. Okay, so here we go. Here's Luke 22:61. Okay, and notice that this time it's singular, not what? Not plural. Okay, remember when we looked at the Matthew example last week, Matthew 27:46, is that the right verse? No, Matthew 26:75, the base text of the bishops had words plural here. So the 1611 adopted it as words plural, and then the editorial change later on took the S off of words and made it what? Word. But here we are now in a parallel passage in Luke, and we can see that notice, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord. So this one, originally, in its base text, was what?
Words.
Not in Luke 22:61, it was what? Word singular. Okay, let's look at the next image. So then when we look at the 1611, we can see that, and Peter remembered the what? The word of the Lord. Okay, so understand what's going on. In the Matthew example, the base text had words with an S. Okay? The King James translators brought that into the 1611 and they left it alone, words with what? An S. Now in a parallel passage in another gospel, talking about the same thing, the base text has the word singular. The King James translators adopt that into the 1611 and they keep it the same here. Okay? Now, Mike, if this is the spot where you feel we need to chat, let me read the statement and then we can... Is this the one?
On page 7.
Okay. So look at the statement here, okay? Just like our example with Matthew 26:75, the King James translator saw no reason to revise the bishop's text in Luke 22:61 and let the word... There's a typo here. It should say the word of the Lord. We need to insert the word of there, Mike.
Okay.
Okay. And let the word of the Lord stand in the 1611 text. This is strong evidence that the King James translators viewed Matthew 26:75 and Luke 22:61 as verbally equivalent to each other, despite not having the exact same words. The decision to change words to word in Matthew 26:75 could have been made to harmonize both of these parallel passages. But they inherit a base text in Matthew 26:75 that says words with an S. They don't change it. That change is made later on in maybe 1677 and 1683. But now if you look at a parallel passage talking about the same thing in another gospel account, they inherit a base text that has just the word without the S. They move that forward into the 1611, and that never gets changed. Is everybody following that? Okay? So, and I'm saying this, notice how I worded this. The decision to change words to word in Matthew 26:75 could, meaning what? Could means maybe, right? So I'm admittingly speculating there a little bit, but it could have been done to harmonize those two passages, okay? The one in Matthew 26 and the one in Luke 22. Anybody got any questions about that example? But here's the bottom line, okay? The bottom line is this. The example that we looked at last time as thinking that it didn't occur until 1743, did it actually occur twice a long time before that? Okay? Now, why would Campbell not know that? Just think it through practically. Why would he not know that?
He might not have access to
those. He might not have had access, and he never looked at them. If he had access and looked at them, he never would have said what he said, right? So here's sort of a underlying theme to this lesson. As good as Campbell and Norton are, and as helpful as they are, they should not be viewed as definitive because they did not look at everything they could have looked at. And I'm not mad at them for it. I'm just saying anything that they say in the book, you have to corroborate through checking other things to know if a date that they ascribe as the first time it read like this is in fact accurate and true. Okay? Any questions before we look at Acts 7:35? Is everybody following what I'm saying? Okay, Acts 7:35? 1683 Cambridge Quarto, H780. Again, here's the change. Remember, this originally said what? Hands. Paris changed this in 1743 according to Campbell, but now we can see that in 1683 there's already a Cambridge Quarto that is changing hands to what? Hand singular. Okay? So if you look at the top page 5, new evidence furnished by a London duodecimo published in 1661, H678, as well as 1677 London editions, show this reading originating before 1683. So now we can go back as far as 1661 in a London duodecimo and in a 1677 London edition and see this reading coming into existence even before 1683. So when Campbell says that this reading originated with F.S. Paris in 1743, is that an accurate statement? It's not an accurate statement. Okay? Let's look at... look at the next image. Here's the duodecimo. Here's 1743 duodecimo. This is a 1661 London duodecimo. And you can see hand right there. Okay? Now I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know what the state of things was in 2005 and 2011, but I think we have an advantage now having all of these editions digitized than these guys had back then. Because they probably would have had to sit there with the actual physical volumes and look this stuff all up by hand in an actual Bible. I don't think I'm out of line in this surmising that there are more digitized editions now in the 2020s than there were 15 or 20 years ago. Okay? If somebody has a strong opinion about that, I'd like to hear it, but I think that's probably true.
I think it would be logical that they assumed that the smaller Bible from the same publisher would be the same as the big Bible.
Correct.
And so
they are operating under a false assumption that the big folios are the flagship editions. And that all they have to do is look at the folios to track the changes, not realizing that changes were being made all the time in the lesser editions. Is everybody following that?
Okay. The public have those, right?
The smaller sizes are the ones that are being sold to individuals.
Well, I would think it came out when they were at church, so when they were reading it, they're going, hey.
Yeah, but I don't think that, I don't know that preaching in these, I'm not saying nobody took their Bible to church back then.
Oh.
But I don't know that it's the same as it is here in our church. Where everybody brings a Bible, and I say, everybody turn to such and such passage, and everybody opens it up. There might have been some of that, but I think most of these people are probably reading these Bibles just for their own reading. I don't want to overstate that, okay? But I'm just not sure that everybody came to church in 1680 carrying their own Bible. I don't know if that happened or not.
Well, a lot of it was illegal, wasn't it?
No.
Not back then?
Before that it would have been. Earlier it would have been.
That's right.
So, look at the statement under that image. As far as we could tell at this time, the change to hand singular was made in a 1661 London duodecimo edition for the first time, and not by F.S. Paris in 1743, as asserted by Campbell. So you see how I'm saying here, as far as we can tell, or as far as the evidence available, right? Because would it be a mistake to say, oh, this the first time this ever happened was in 1661? Well, we know enough now to know, would that be a mistake? Because as soon as I say that, is somebody going to find one from 1650 that already had the change in it? But nobody it's just that nobody looked at the one from 1650 yet.
So it wasn't even Hayes that was the original?
No. It was done before that by this one in 1661. So Hayes, the one bearing Hayes' name in 1683 isn't even the first one. The first one we know of right now is this one right here from 1661. Okay? So let's look at Exodus 34:25. So again, guys, these are verses that we already went through last week, and now I'm coming back over them and showing you, wait a minute, these things were already revised earlier on, or edited earlier on. Okay? So in the case of Exodus 34:25, there is evidence from a London edition published in 1646, catalog number is unknown to me at this time, and a family Bible published in 1762, H1144, of the verse being edited to read the Feast of the Passover before the 1762 Paris Quarto edition noted above and cited in the previous lesson. So, here we have a 1646 London. I don't know, I can't determine at this time exactly which catalog number it is in Herbert, but notice, okay, shall sacrifice of the feast of the what?
Passover
is the definite article added by a London edition in 1646. Okay? And then here we have another one. This is the Family Bible from 1762. I have the date on here at 1762 based upon what I've researched. And you'll see again, of the Feast of the Passover is the definite article there before Paris' edition that read similarly. Okay? So, let's go to page 6. So we're getting to the example you wrote me about, right, Mike?
And about the last page, there's a difference between the capitalization of Passover. Does that make any sense?
Well, that's... I think you just have different preferences here, right? So here it's not capitalized, here it is.
Well, I mean, when they put the Passover, it does sound like it's an event.
Yeah.
More than just a...
Right. All right, let's look at Ezra 7:18. So here we have again our 1683 Cambridge Quarto Edition, H780. And we're looking at this right here, okay, of the silver and the gold. In the 1602 bishops, the 1611 King James, the 1629, 1638 Cambridge, the word the was not there. It read of the silver and what? Gold, and then that word the is inserted, right? Last week we thought it was done by Paris in 1743. We now see it occurring in a 1683 Cambridge edition, okay? So based upon our current understanding of the evidence, the edition of the to Ezra 7:18 was made in 1680 in the 1683 Cambridge Quarto edition before the reading showed up in the 1743 Cambridge Duodecimo edition edited by Paris. Now, this is where this gets interesting. Okay? So, before leaving Ezra 7, we should note some additional observations pointed out to me by Christopher Yetzer. Okay? Now, look at verse, so here we have just a few verses up. The verse we looked at last time was Ezra 7:18. Now let's look at verses 15 and 16. Okay? Notice here, verse 15, and to carry the silver and the what? The gold. Okay? Verse 16, okay? And all the silver and what? The gold. So now we see in 1683, a few verses up from the example that we just, our main example of verse 18, do we see the being added in these two verses as well? Okay? So let's read the statement. In this 1683 edition, the word the was added to verses 15 and 16 in addition to verse 18. Based on our current understanding of the extant evidence, this was the first edition to add the word the to Ezra 7:15 and 16. Consider the following earlier printings. Okay? So now if you go to page 7, we're going to start with our base text of the 1602 bishops. Okay? Now watch, verse 15. And that thou shouldest take with thee silver and what?
Oh.
What is not there?
The.
Okay? Verse 16. And all the silver and what?
Gold.
What is not there?
The.
When we look at these in this 1683 again, what do we see?
The
and what?
The.
So the base text of the 1602 bishops does not have the word the in verses 15 and 16. Okay? So, the base, scroll up that up. The base text in here by the King James translators did not have the word the before gold in Ezra 7:15 and 16. Now, let's look at the King James 1611. Okay, so here's the 1611. Now watch. And to carry the silver and what? What's not there?
The.
Now why is the not there? Probably, most likely, because it wasn't here. So they just moved it what? Forward without the word the. Now we might have some more to say about some of this in a second. Let's look at verse 16. Okay? Verse 16, and all the silver and what? What's not there?
The.
Okay? Now, Mike, I think if I'm understanding you right, you were pointing out to me, so Mike had the benefit of seeing these notes in draft form before they were proofread. Okay? Now, I think what Mike is pointing out to me is that this verse was edited. Okay? So, let's look carefully. Here's verse 15. Here's the 1602 bishops. And that thou shouldest take with thee silver and gold. Now, do we agree that... I think this is thee. Take with thee.
Yeah.
Do we agree?
Yeah.
So, here's the 1602 bishops. And that thou shouldest take with thee silver and gold. Okay? Now watch how that changes in the 1611. And to carry the silver and what? So here is the point. Okay? Did they edit the first line of that verse?
Yes.
Okay? And in editing it, what did they not add? They did not add the definite article before what?
Gold.
Notice here, okay? With the silver and what? Do they add a definite article before silver?
Yes.
That's not in the 1602.
Right.
Shake your head yes, because that, but they don't add it where?
Before gold.
Before gold.
And they have the word carry.
And they have carry. Instead of this,
instead of
thou shouldest take with thee.
So the whole sentence has been revised.
The whole sentence has been revised, but what has not been added before the word gold?
The. They also changed after and his counselors to his counselors have freely offered instead of his counselors offered.
Correct. So What you're pointing out there, Bart, is additional changes after the clause we're talking about, right? So, here's the takeaway. Is that verse heavily edited by the King James translators in their company work, verse 15? Is verse 15 heavily edited between where it started in the 1602 bishops and where it ends up in the King James 1611?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay? But in all of the editing that was done by the translators to the verse, what did they not add? They did not add the definite article before what?
Gold.
Okay? Now, we could probably do something similar with verse 16, although I haven't looked at verse 16 as much. It starts off with, "And all the silver and gold that thou canst find," I think that's canst, right?
Canst.
"Find in all the country of Babylon." Okay? So let's look at that in the 1611. Notice, "And all the silver and gold that thou canst find in all the province." So do they change country to province?
Yep.
Of Babylon, okay? So there's less editing going on in that clause in verse 16 than there was in verse 15, but what are they still not adding before gold?
The.
Okay, now, what am I getting at? Not having the gold would seem to be the intentional choice of who? The translators. So later on, does an editor insert the definite article into the verse? Okay? So, let's read on the bottom of page 7. But guys, you just have to understand that what we're looking at here isn't supposed to be the case according to standard King James only talking points. Okay? And so somebody like me comes along and points this stuff out and takes it on the chin because I'm saying I'm not towing the party line. Okay? But I want to be accurate to what actually happened. Okay? So, bottom of 7. The translators did not see fit, so I think, Mike, this is where you think I need to edit this, okay?
If you're talking just about verse 16, or you're talking about both 15 and 16, 15 has been completely changed.
15 has definitely been completely changed, and there's edits in 16 as well.
Yeah, the free will.
So, the way it reads right now, and I'm gonna have to work on figuring out how to clean this up. When I wrote this, I was simply looking at the word "the" or not, whether the word "the" was there or not. Okay. So, the statement I have in the notes still makes sense when you think about it just from those terms. But if you expand the gaze to include the rest of the verses, more changes were obviously made, right? So, the translators did not see fit to edit the 1602 bishops in this case, seeing that the 1611 follows the base text in reading all of the silver and gold without what?
And of should be removed because it's not in there.
All right, so strike that, okay? But, it gets better. So here we have the same two verses in the 1629 Cambridge Folio, okay? And notice, "And to carry the silver and what?" Nova. Nova there, or verse 16. "And all the silver and what?" And gold, here's the 1638 Cambridge Folio edition. "And to carry the silver and gold," verse 16, "and to carry the silver and gold," what's not there? So despite the changes, notice "carry" is spelled different. Here, it's C-A-C-A-R-R-I-E. And in the previous one, it was what? C-A-R-R-Y. So, are they making changes here, but they're not doing anything with what?
The gold.
The gold. And if the King James translators are supposedly working on the 1629 and the 1638, are they electing to add the word gold? The answer is what? No. I said that somewhat sarcastically, okay?
You got two people that are spelling the words differently because I think some are still old school. They want to spell it the way and the other one, so they want to spell it the English, but not the
Bible. Yeah, but these are both done in the 1600s in England. So what this is telling you is that even in England, was their unsettled orthography of how to spell words.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this isn't like a modern spelling versus an old spelling. This is like within 10 years of each other, how do you want to spell this word? Okay? Now, I was being somewhat sarcastic a moment ago. We don't have any evidence that any translators worked on the 1629. We do have evidence, if you recall, from the pen of William Kilburn, that Boyce and Ward, Samuel Ward, worked on the 1638. Okay? So despite the changes to the spelling of the word carry, both Cambridge Folio editions from 1629 and 1638 leave the phrase, all of the silver and gold unchanged. Okay? So now, here's the Paris one. And what do we have? What's inserted? The. Okay? And then we can go to the... Now, this is crazy. Okay? So Paris, in 1743... Let me just double-check one thing here. Let me back up. So we first see the change to verses 15 and 16 in the 1683 Cambridge. So notice... 1683 Cambridge. What's here?
The gold.
The gold in both, right? And we just went through an exercise demonstrating that the gold is not in the base text of the 1602 bishops. It's not in the 1611. It's not in the 1629 or 1638 Cambridge editions. The first time we can find it as of right now is in a 1683. Okay? Now, but watch what happens. So I just got to get to the right page. So page 9. So here's Paris. The gold, the gold. Now, as of last week, we thought this was the first time this happened. But it's not, because we now know it happened in 1683. Is everybody following me? Okay? Now, look at the next iteration. The 1743 Cambridge duodecimo, edited by F.S. Paris, follows the earlier 1683 Cambridge by reading all the silver and the gold in Ezra 7:15-16. So once again, Paris was not the first editor to make this change. Okay, but now look at the 1769 Blaney. Somebody in here, turn in your Bible to Ezra chapter 7, verse 15. Ezra chapter 7, verse 15. So here's the Blaney edition of 1769, and notice, and to carry the silver and what? Has it been taken out? The has been taken out of verse 15. Okay? Look at verse 17. And all the silver and what? Gold. It's taken out of verse 16. So Amy, will you read those for me and read verse 15?
And to carry the silver and gold, which the king and his counselors have freely offered unto the God of Israel, whose habitation is in Jerusalem.
16.
And all the silver and gold.
Okay, stop. Okay. So, in your Bible, what's not there?
No.
Look at verse 18, please. Read the first clause, if you would.
And whatsoever shall seem good to thee and to thy brethren to do with the rest of the silver and the gold.
So it's kept in verse 18. The definite article is kept in verse 18, but it's removed in verse what?
15
and 16. So it wasn't there, then it was there, then it what? Wasn't there. Are you following that? So look at the statement underneath. The current text, edited by Benjamin Blaney for Oxford University Press in 1769, removes the word the from Ezra 7:15-16. Herein we see an example of an editorial change being undone by a later editor. If one purchased a 1683 or 1743 Cambridge Bible, did they not possess the pure Word of God because they had extra words in Ezra 7:15 and 16 when compared against a 1611 or a standard 1769 text? Is everybody following my question? Standard King James only talking points would say that that's a corruption. It has extra words. Every word of God is pure. Can't have, all the words have to be there. They all have to be in the right order. So if you're going to make that, this is what I keep coming back to, right? This is why we're doing this. Because the people who are making these statements have never looked at any of this. Or they've never looked beyond, most of them hate Norton, okay, because they don't like certain things about him. I don't love everything about Norton, okay? He says a lot of things that I don't agree with him about, but they won't even look at it because they don't like the guy. Well, now what we're finding is that some of the stuff Norton said wasn't even true. The story is more complicated than even he records in a massive book in 2004, 2005. Okay, so let me read it again. If one purchased a 1683 or 1743 Cambridge Bible, did they not possess the, quote, pure word of God because they had extra words in Ezra 7, 15, and 16 when compared against a 1611 or a standard 1769 text? This is absurd and highlights why the insistence upon verbatim identicality of wording, i.e. jot and tittle preservation, as the standard for preservation is out of step with the historical and textual facts. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So stop saying it. Stop demanding it. Okay? All of the editions of the AV are verbally equivalent in Ezra 7, 15, and 16, despite not possessing what? Verbatim identicality. Okay? Let's look at the next one. Matthew 16, 16. Notice, here again, we have a 1683 Cambridge quarto. And Simon Peter answered and said, "Thou art the Christ." Last Sunday, we said that that occurred for the first time in 1743. Look at the statement underneath. Based upon what can currently be proven, the addition of the definite article in Matthew 16, 16 was made in a 1683 Cambridge edition bearing the name of Hayes, and not by F.S. Paris as asserted by Campbell. It could be argued that this was possibly done to harmonize Matthew 16 with Mark 8:29 and John 11:27, which both record Peter as saying, "Thou art the what?"
The Christ.
The Christ. Okay? I'm speculating there, admittedly, but that could be maybe related to why that change is made. Luke 19:9. Okay? Here we have our one. "For as much as also he is a son of Abraham," remember from last week that originally said the son of who? Abraham. And here we have again a 1683 Cambridge. So, judging based upon my current understanding of the extant evidence, the change from the son of Abraham to a son of Abraham in Luke 19:9 was made in a 1683 Cambridge edition bearing the name of Hayes and not by F.S. Paris asserted by Campbell. Luke 20 verse 12. Okay? And again, he sent a third versus the third. Look at underneath. And again, notice 1683 Cambridge is where this change is first being observed. Based upon what can be proven at this time, the change he sent the third to he sent a third in Luke 20 verse 12 was first made in a 1683 Cambridge printing and not by F.S. Paris as asserted by Campbell. Okay? And then we have John 15:20 on page 11, where again we see the same 1683 Cambridge. Okay? And here, I don't have it marked, it would be this right here. Mike, remind me, I need to underline on this example, okay? It's right here. "The servant is not greater than his" what?
Lord.
Okay? It used to say greater than the what? The Lord. So read that. "As far as can be determined at this time, the change from greater than the Lord to greater than his Lord in John 15:20 was first made in a 1683 Cambridge printing and not by F.S. Paris as asserted by Campbell. Once again, it could be argued that this was possibly done to harmonize John 15 verse 20 with John 13 verse 16. Again, I'm just saying that's why. That's possible. I'm not saying that's why it was done. I'm saying it's possible. I already read that. So now we have an additional example. This is an example from Campbell that we didn't have time for last week. So, Acts 5:34. In lesson 249, we quoted pages 132 through 134 of Gordon Campbell's book, Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011, and used it to frame our discussion of Paris's work. There was one example from these pages that we did not have time to cover. Consider the following additional example from Acts 5, verse 34. The words of Campbell are in quotation marks. My commentary is in the bracketed section. So here's the example, quoting Campbell. As the description of Gamaliel as a doctor of law is changed to a doctor of what?
The
law. All right, and here's the change. So here's 1743 F.S. Paris. What's inserted in there?
The
definite article. Go to page 12. So we're looking at the whole example here because we didn't get it last time. Notice, base text, 1602 Bishop's Bible, referring to Gamaliel, a doctor of what?
Law.
What's not there?
The.
Look at the 1611, named Gamaliel, a doctor of what?
Law.
What's not in the 1611?
The.
What was not in the base text of 1602?
The
1629 Cambridge, a doctor of law. What's missing?
The
verse 34, a doctor of law. What's missing?
The
so the 1602 bishops, 1611 AV, 1629, and 1638 Cambridge folios all read a doctor of law in Acts 5:34. Consider the following additional image. So here on page 13 we have once again our 1683 Cambridge, and notice what it says. Name Gamaliel, a doctor of what? Mike, make a note, I need to underline this one too.
Okay,
page 13.
Yeah.
Okay. So the change that we thought was originally made by F.S. Paris in 1743 is once again made before that in 1683. Okay? So judging by the available evidence, the change to a doctor of the law was made in the Cambridge edition from 1683 and not the F.S. Paris edition as asserted by Dr. Campbell. Here is the rest of the quote from Dr. Campbell about Acts, or regarding Acts 5:34, referring to adding the, presumably to avoid the suggestion he had been awarded a degree by a university. This is, of course, only a partial solution, as doctor meant teacher in the 17th century. Paris might usefully have disposed of the word doctor. That is Campbell's opinion. Okay? So in other words, it's not that he had a PhD doctor. He was a teacher of what? The law. And the word doctor meant what?
Teacher.
I think that's pretty self-explanatory. So let's move ahead.
One question.
Yeah.
Did you check the 61 London Douay Decimal?
What page are you on?
Page 5.
Oh.
He was credited with correction in 1677, but in 1661, the London Douay Decimal already had that change. And I'm wondering if the other changes that have been mentioned.
Nope. So any of the other changes that have been mentioned outside of the 1683 are only applying where I name them.
I just wondering.
Yeah. So, page 13. So, of the 10, I'm right here.
I'm reading from right here.
So, the 10 examples of Paris's editorial work furnished by Dr. Campbell on pages 132 to 134 of his book, 8 changes had already been made in the Cambridge Quarto edition of 1683, some earlier than that. Okay? This is yet another cautionary tale of ascribing the exact origin of a given reading in the printed history of the King James text to a specific edition. One must have checked every edition of the authorized version ever printed to know for sure the exact origin of a given reading. Now, if any of you have that kind of time, I mean, I have some files you can go through for me, okay? Is everybody understanding what I'm getting at there? Okay, so I want to try to make it through this additional information. Okay, so we have already seen Professor Norton falling victim to this error when commenting on the textual history of the Authorized Version during the 1630s by only checking the flagship folios of Cambridge University 1629 and 1638. Norton missed additional editorial work done in the lesser Cambridge editions of that decade. And again, by lesser, I just mean smaller sizes. Okay? See Lesson 237 for more information. Norton makes the same error now when dealing with the editorial work of F.S. Paris. So the same error he made in the 1630s, he's making it again here with F.S. Paris. Okay? Christopher Yetzer produced an Excel spreadsheet listing all the examples of changes attributed to Paris by Norton in the main text of A Textual History of the King James Bible. This does not include any additional examples that might be found in Appendix 8 at the back of the book. We're only talking about the ones that he dealt with in the main text of the book. Okay, now check this out. Of the 63 examples contained in the list, 23 of them, or 36.5%, had already been edited in 1683 by Cambridge University Press in their quarto edition. In addition to the 8 examples already covered in Lessons 249 and 250, we've already done that, please note the following additional changes found in the 1683 Cambridge Quarto. Lastly, the other column records editions other than a 1683 Cambridge, which contained the change, although it should not be taken as definitive since not every printing was checked. Okay? So look at the table on page 14. So these are additional examples to the ones that we've just looked at. Okay? Let me show you how to read the table. We're not going to have time to read every line. Okay? Well, here's the verse, Genesis 23:18. Here's the change. Gate to gate. Okay? And what's the nature of the change? It's a plural to what? The singular. Other records, what other editions do we know of at this time that had that change already? And they included a 1640 Cambridge, a 46, a 63, a 65, a 71, a blah, blah, blah. All of those already have. So it seems like this became the standard reading by 1640. So we follow how to read the table. Okay? So, we have about 6 minutes. There is one here that is intriguing to me. Everybody look at 2 Samuel, the 2 Samuel 4:4. Somebody find that in your Bible. I'm going to find it in the 1611. Okay, 2 Samuel 4:4 is the one I want to focus on. I only have time to really talk about one of these before I have time to make my conclusions, okay? 4:4. Okay. So if I'm in the right spot, is this the right verse in Jonathan?
Yes.
Okay. Now we want to zero in, look at the table here. We want to zero in on the part of this where it says feet and was 5 years. Okay? Feet and was 5 years. So 1611, right here. Okay? Was lame of his feet and was what?
5 years.
5 years. Okay? Now, Amy, how does that read in your 1769?
And Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son that was lame of his feet.
Period?
Period. He was 5 years old when the tidings came.
Okay, so it says that was lame of his feet, period.
Mm-hmm.
Yours has a period here, right?
Yes.
And then it says what?
He was.
So there's the word and is taken out.
That's right.
And there's a he inserted.
Yes.
Right? And it says he was 5 years old. That's a change.
It is.
Okay? That change, so that's a wording change. That's a repunctuation and a reorganization of what? The sentence. That is an editorial change. Okay? So again, we're on this line right here of all this. We're looking at 2 Samuel 4:4. So you have revised sentence structure, and there's evidence of this actually occurring as early as 1677.
They took the old out too, just 5 years. At the end of it.
He was 5 years old, is what it currently says.
It says 5 years on that. That's old.
I think.
Oh, I just think it cut it off here, Bart.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, is that an editorial change, folks? That's a period instead of a comma, a dropping of the italics and putting in he instead. Okay? And so we know that this happens as early as 1677. Okay? Now, I don't have time to run this entire list. So, this will be memorialized in these notes. If you want to look at all of these, I definitely commend. I'm just looking at the one that is the most consequential, in my opinion, where you see clear editorial change going on. Okay, so let's get to the conclusions and takeaways. So I commend to you the rest of the table. It's important to look at it, and hopefully some people will online. Okay, so in conclusion, please note the following takeaways. Number one. Ascribing the precise date of origin for a given reading in the printed history of the King James text is a cautionary tale unless one has looked at every edition ever printed. You see why I'm saying that? I mean, look at just a few of these other things. Some of these things, look at this one here. Told Jesus to tell Jesus. Revised verb tense. There's evidence from a 1621 and then that happened all the way back there. So again, do you have this text being printed with verbatim identicality ever in this entire period from 1611 to 1769? Not one time. Okay? Number two. Bottom of page 14. The work of Campbell and Norton, while extremely helpful and beneficial, is not definitive and needs to be checked against other printings. Because they didn't look at every one printed. Top page 15. The printed history of the King James text is not as neat and tidy as many would like it to be. The text was never printed with uniformity between 1611 and 1769. Editorial changes were made to the text despite the claims of some to the contrary. This is why demanding verbatim identicality of wording as a standard for preservation is an unhelpful standard and logically leads to one having to declare which edition printed everything perfectly to the exclusion of all others. If that is your standard, then you have to tell me which is the one that got everything right, and anything that didn't get it right would therefore not be pure. That's absurd to me. Okay? Number three. It is not correct to think of the history of the text in terms of four monolithic revisions occurring in 1629, 1638, 1762, and 1769. The real story unfolds year by year and printing by printing. Therefore, statements such as the following are grossly incorrect. Quote, the first two revisions of the King James Bible occurred within 27 years of the original Oxford printing. The original printing occurred at London, not Oxford. That's a flat-out mistake. The 1629 and 1638 editions, both printed at Cambridge, focused on the correction of printing errors. Two of the original translators worked on the 1629 edition. No extant historical evidence corroborates this statement. The other two revisions of 1762 and 1769 focused more on the standardization of spelling. A case could be made that there were two editions instead of four revisions because the first two and the last two were done close together and were stages of the same process. That is absolutely false. That did not occur. That is an incorrect statement, and it's not even close to reality. You following me? I'm sorry to be so blunt about it, but that's the truth. So finally, the last point, and then we're going to have to quit. This is important. The 1683 Cambridge Quarto, H780, seems like a massively undervalued edition when assessing the printed history of the text. This is interesting given that the 1683 was the last Cambridge edition to be published until the Paris edition of 1743. So remember, guys, we talked about how the Cambridge press went dormant for a while and how they were receiving cash payment to not print the text. The 1683 is like the last one they did before this dormant period. The next one they do is this Paris one of 1743. Okay? Recall that Cambridge University Press went dormant for a period in terms of printing Bibles in the late 17th and early 18th century. Given that more than 35% of the changes ascribed to Paris by Norton and Campbell had already been made in 1683, one wonders if Paris utilized the last Cambridge printing as the base text for his work. That makes perfect sense to me. So Paris is sitting here in the 1740s, and he goes back to the last Cambridge one printed, 1683. 35% of the changes that are recorded in the Paris edition of 1743 had already been made in the Cambridge edition of 1683. So, unfortunately, we're out of time. Does anybody have any comments or brief questions? Because we got to pack up and get in the other room for church. But any comments or questions? All right. If there's not, I'm going to go ahead and shut the equipment down. Appreciate everybody's... Oh, one last thing. Next Sunday. So, next Sunday and the Sunday after, I'm on Christmas break. I'm taking a break from this for 2 weeks. Next Sunday, my dad will be in town. He's going to teach the adult Sunday school hour. Okay? And then the following Sunday, we'll do something, maybe Q&A or something. We'll be here, we'll meet, but it's not going to be on this. I need a break for a couple weeks of all this research. It took me hours to put this together this week. So,